right. Well, hey, Drew. Hi, AJ. Welcome to Ideology. Thank you for tuning in. And if for some reason this is your very first Ideology episode, welcome. We're in season four, and we've been going through a book study on James K.A. Smith's How Not to Be Secular. We've been plodding through it because it's been a rich study. And today we're going to attempt to tackle chapters four and five, though five was like half the book, it felt like.
It's very long.
So we'll see where we get today. But a great book. If you've just been tracking along with the podcast and haven't picked up the book, I'd recommend it. It's a helpful synthesis of Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, which I have not read, but I have heard is quite a read. Really good material, but can be a bit dense to work through. So this is a bit more of an accessible work to access Charles Taylor's work. So with that, Drew, why don't you just dive right in? Chapter four, How Not to Be Secular.
Yeah, so let's start with four. And my goal, because five is so long, and I think four really builds on themes that we've already discussed, I'm going to do a brief overview of what I saw with four. And Mick, if you want to chime in there, and then we'll focus today mainly on five. And so Taylor, he introduces, I think it's Foucault's idea of unthoughts. And we've talked about that at length with this book already. And so not the propositional ideas that we have at the front of our minds, but the default framework that we don't even realize that we have, the things that we don't think about that are more in the world that we inhabit that then we use to develop our propositions. So what he is doing is he is reviewing history, and he's doing it in an alternative way. He's making sense of how we got here, and he's looking at it from his own Catholic perspective. So he covers three areas. He calls it he uses the French, the ancient regime, or how do you even say that?
I'm not a French speaker. Ancien.
I feel like you just offended any French people that may have listened to this. I apologize.
A-N-C-I-E-N. Any French speakers out there can help us out. Ancien. The Ancien regime.
That would be a great podcast of French words with a Texas accent.
Yeah. Oh, mercy. Hey, by the way, congratulations, Kansas City Chiefs. I know
an amazing game.
That was a fun game.
It was a fun game.
If you're a Chiefs fan, if you're a 49ers fan.
Yeah, I feel like everybody's now starting to take shots at the Chiefs because we're so good.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway. So, congratulations. Go Chiefs. Ancien regime.
Yes. So that's number one. Number two is the age of mobilization. And then the third is what he calls the age of authenticity. And this tracks with maybe in some ways the story that he tells of secularism 1, 2, and 3. He's taking that story and he's putting it into some historical developments that he sees and using kind of the story of history to make sense of his secularism thesis. So this first one, the ancient regime, not the however else we might say it, what he is saying is there is this inextricable link between religious and political identity. And within that, there is all these rituals, all of the whole world is ordered in such a way where it's mutually reinforcing. So what I believe spiritually is being reinforced with cultural symbolism, which is reinforced in the political order. And so it's this nice, tight way of understanding the world. He does say there is vulnerability, at a certain point where there's some defections among the elite, meaning, you know, as there's thoughts developing and some of these early, what later became secularism ideals come along, there are some elite people that are starting to challenge it or tear at the fabric, if I can use that illustration. But for the average person, the world is kind of set within this mutually reinforcing belief system. Now, I do want to pause here because I think I could offer not a critique, but an alternative thought or way of looking at things is this is not the only story of Christianity in the world. If you think of the early church, they did not live in a world where everything was reinforcing. They had the opposite problem. They were in an idol-worshipping Roman world, and so what was being reinforced was against the church. You could look at the church in the Far East, places like Persia, eventually churches that were living under Muslim rule, the church that spread into India. There was, you know, all throughout the history of the church, there has been plenty of believers that did not live in this ancient regime or Christendom mentality. In fact, I think, I can't remember who wrote it, somebody told a story of the lost history of Eastern Christianity. So not the Orthodox Church, but the far Eastern Christianity. And the stat they gave was that in the year 1000 AD, there were more churches meeting or more believers gathered in far Eastern Christianity than there were under the authority of the Bishop of Rome in mm-hmm. Western Catholicism, which I think is fascinating to me, you know, because we tend to tell history only from a Western Catholic or these days also including Greek Orthodox, but forget that that's not the only story of the church. So I just want to throw that caveat in there because I think we can have too narrow a view if we simply accept that at one point all of Christians lived with this mutually reinforcing Christendom, ancient regime mentality that has then been turned into something else. I think this is the story of one branch of Christianity. But that all being said, I think it is incredibly instructive for us. Mm-hmm. The age of mobilization is that God is present in his design and order. And so then society conforms to the divine order. And so there's the distinction here is that if the first stage is sacramental presence, which means like all of life is intertwined, the second stage is not sacramental presence, but is more about order. And you can see this in the Protestant Reformation for sure. So it's looking at Scripture, looking at God, and the logic, the reasonableness that God is the designer, and still very much Christian. So it's not any backing off of that, but it's emphasizing God's order. And so rather than me naively inhabiting a world that's infused with the sacramental presence of God, now as a logical creature, I am discerning God's order in the world, and I'm trying to match the order that I create to the order that God has provided.
Yeah, which maybe tacitly opened the door, or not tacitly, but led directly to deism as a manifestation of that. Maybe not inevitably, but certainly when you combine that with kind of Enlightenment thought and then the Industrial Revolution, Darwin, and so on and so forth, all that combined that, you know, God is the great clockmaker who set everything in motion and stands back from creation. Reading a lot of the biographies of the kind of the era of the founding fathers, that seemed to be a predominant way of viewing the world around the time of the founding of our nation.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And I think it's what opened the door for later developments where instead of it being God is the God of order, therefore we conform to God's order, we see that there's order in the universe and then we as humans create meaning within the order of the universe. And so God is being slowly stripped out of this. I think Taylor would argue that that's not inevitable, and I would say, you know, I mean, he's a Catholic, so he might be a little more nostalgic for what we started with. As somebody who's not Catholic, I think I can look at all of these epics and say that there were some serious flaws within those. I don't look back with longing to the ancient regime of Christendom and a mutually reinforcing society of faith. That to me, that's not the good old days or the glory days. And I think as Protestants, we shouldn't look back to the age of order before deism as the good old days. You know, I think instead, maybe a better way of looking at it is these are cultural developments that the church inhabits, mm-hmm. each of which accent areas that I think are right and are beneficial within the context of faith, and each of which I think presents problems for the church. So I want to be careful here. I'm not telling this story morally as best, better, bad, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that leads to the age of authenticity. We're about to make that pivot there.
Yeah, exactly. So it's expressive individualism. Primary value is choice and tolerance. Primary value is choice, and then tolerance is the last remaining virtue. I think that's such an interesting mm-hmm. idea. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm more critical on some of these ideas. But before I get into the critique, which I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on because we've covered it at length, I want to start by saying, just like with the other two, the world is sacramental. I think it's a beautiful idea. God's order in the world is a beautiful idea. And I think us as individuals who uniquely display the glory of God is a beautiful idea. Mm-hmm. So the orienting principle in all three of these has the potential for great things. I'm probably more acutely aware of the negative ramifications of the age of authenticity simply because that's the world we live in today. I might be more critical of the ancient regime if that was the world I lived in then. And so I that's the task for each generation of the church is to confront the cultural assumptions that hinder us from the things of God. He had this quote, I just thought it was so brilliant, page 85, that fashion hovers on the boundary between solipsism and communication. And meaning it's right there of like, this is purely my self-expression and that's all I care about. It's just me, kind of this isolated ego individual. And at the same time, that's actually how I communicate to you. So what's important with that, and he's just using this as one example, the starting point is me almost communicating to myself who I want to be, but the very act of me doing that is then how I relate to other people. I'm starting with my own expression. That's the essence of who I am. And then my own expression is how I then engage in relationships with other people. So I start with myself. I don't start my communication with the other. And I thought that was an insightful comment, and that's probably one of many other ways that we could analyze culture today to make the point. I think we see within this, if I was going to maybe take a shot at even our own church circles, we can easily fall into this where we can so obsess over spiritual gifts, some type of identity profiling, Enneagram, you know, any of these types of things, where what we're really concerned with is how do I express my own uniqueness? And then I almost understand my vocation, my calling, my church involvement, my interpersonal relationships entirely through the grid of my own uniqueness. And so we can baptize this impulse in a way that I don't think is helpful. Mm-hmm. I think all those tools can be great. So I'm supportive of those tools. But I think when those tools become a means of identity, we've drifted off somewhere and maybe we're more caught up in the expressive individualism of our current age than we are with a more biblical understanding of ourselves embedded in a community that bring individual contributions.
Yeah, and it may be helpful to think of it along the lines of a spectrum where maybe in the ancient regime, you were subsumed into the collective, right? There's very little in the way of individual expression or individual rights or even individual belief, which Jesus and Paul were some of the primary voices of, you know, the ancient world who were trumpeting individual accountability, individual faith, individual responsibility before God, against the backdrop of that kind of collectivism. Mm-hmm. But then you fast forward and the slider moves all the way across the spectrum to this hyper-individualism, which again, we've talked about at length, but the sweet spot's probably somewhere there in the middle. And I'm thinking back to Tim Keller's article on justice and how he talks about biblical justice is a combination of an individual responsibility and corporate responsibility. And I would think maybe that's an analog here where mm-hmm. there is a communal nature to being human where, you know, we talk about individual church involvement where I don't, certainly in our expression, there's not a huge emphasis on membership. As I'm getting a little older, I've been reflecting more on that and this idea of commitment. What does commitment to the body of Christ look like? And I love that we're not, again, subsumed by the collective, and we do have the ability to choose and to kind of voluntarily participate in the body of Christ. But then at what point do I elevate commitment to a local body of Christ over my own comfort or my own well-being? You know, those are complex and complicated mm-hmm. conversations, and there are, of course, times to switch churches and so on. But that consumeristic individualism that places me at the center of the equation, that as soon as I don't prefer something, some kind of expression, or somebody offends me in some way, that I have very little attachment and I can easily float to the next local body, I think would be a negative manifestation, even though there are some positives associated with that, a negative manifestation of this age of authenticity.
He said this thing that in the age of authenticity, consumer identity trumps collective identities, which I think speaks to what you're saying, Mick. I was trying to think through examples, and one that stood out to me was the concept of generations. And so you hear a ton, you know, I'm a millennial, and then you hear about Gen X or Boomers or Gen Z or Gen Alpha. That from as best I can understand in some of the research I've done, that's not a thing from a sociologist. That you don't really see that. Like there's not, what I've seen is that the better way to look at it is more tightly defined age brackets. So it's a very new concept of generations as we understand it. And it really came back towards, I think it was the Great Depression. People were looking at how do these massive societal upheavals affect generational mindsets. And they were looking at people who lived through, you know, the Great Depression and World War II, and looking at how if you, you know, your formative years were spent intertwined with those world events, then it changes your outlook on things. So that's like the ball got rolling at with this. But, you know, what they're saying, as best I can tell from research, is that this arbitrarily defined generation, where if you're born between this year and that year, it makes you this type of person. It's not really scientifically accurate or sociologically accurate, maybe the better way of saying that. Could be like if you came of age right at, you know, 9/11, like that was my freshman year of college. Maybe for those of us, there was a few world events that give us something, but probably the way that we were raised in our family, other parts of our life were a lot more formative than those events were. And we draw these arbitrarily lines. So why does it get talked about so much? Because it's a really nice consumer identity. And so if I can position people that you're Gen Z, if you fit in this bracket, then I can sell stuff to you. And I can, you know, like think about like an executive at TikTok. Like we're going to make our marketing strategy around reaching Gen Z, and we're going to position ourselves as the Gen Z social media platform, and Instagram's the millennial social media platform, and Facebook is, we won't make a comment there. But you know, you have like, you can just see the utility of it. If I can start selling you things, if I can get you to buy into a consumer identity, then I can pitch my product to you. But it's not an actual identity. Mm-hmm. And so we've traded actual identities for consumer identities. And I just thought that was one of many examples probably where that's taken place.
You didn't work your way all the way back to MySpace. Would that be a zennial?
Here's my thing. Wouldn't it be fun to bring it back? Like, could we get a core of people to all recolonize MySpace and
chat with each other on Merc? Did you ever use Merc?
I never did. It sounds terrible.
It was the predecessor to AOL Messenger. Oh my gosh, Instant Messenger.
That's digging deep.
Yes.
I really did think about MySpace though. Like, why not just go there? I mean, it's probably could make a great social media experience because no one else is there. It could just be our own little kingdom.
Fire up AOL, dial up, and get
that
on.
Would be amazing.
Yes.
So there's a last thing on chapter four I want to hit. In Taylor's account, he's kind of saying, you know, what are some of maybe the church impulses? In the original, the ancient regime, the church is the fabric of society. That's the way that it's understood. Is you know, maybe a background thought. And that's where still today, I think you get cultural Christianity or in parts of Europe, the Volk Church, you know, this is so embedded with identity that you really can't think of it as separate things. So
it'd be like the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah. Orthodox Church would still fully, at least they might cultural, teach it, yeah, but I don't know if people believe it in the same way. I think the world has changed.
It's like a cultural identity.
But it's within that, you know, even the concept of church membership or attendance is de-emphasized because it's really more about a cultural identity and the fabric of a society than it is anything else. The Age of Mobilization is a right-ordered church. And so it's a lot of it is how is the church correctly ordered? What he says, and I think this is really insightful, is that in the Age of Authenticity, we have actually an anti-institutional impulse that drives a lot of things. And it makes a lot of sense if you track his logic, because if I prioritize my own self-expression and if I prioritize my own individualism, then that's going to give me a suspicion of something that might get in the way of that. And so we tend to approach any type of collective identity with suspicion because we're worried it might infringe upon our ability to express ourselves individualistically. Now, Taylor ends with what I think is a really important point, is that we don't want to go back to the earlier ages. And so if you read this and you think, man, they had it better back then, we should just go back in time. I think that's not a helpful thought process. And I think we can sometimes whitewash our past and we look at our present problems and we're like, well, they didn't deal with that in the past, so why don't we just go back to what we did in the past? The reality is the past had equal, if not much greater problems. And, you know, go read some of the history stories of the 30 Years' War, for example, or go read, you know, what was it actually like for the average, you know, Catholic living in the high Middle Ages, or, you know, go look at even some of the early Protestants. And of course, there's examples of vibrant believers, but it's not as though there's this period of time 300, you know, 400 years ago. I think as Protestants, we might, you know, wish we could go back to the year 1600s, maybe Catholic, it might be the year 1250, or, you know, we can just set this arbitrary time. Evangelicals, maybe it's 1950, you know, and we could just think that's when they had it good. And the reality is, at that time, they had equal problems, maybe just different problems. So that the goal is not to go back. The goal is to diagnose what it is today And then we can ask the question, how do we rightly understand the age in which we live, and what would it look like for us to live faithful? And we can celebrate some of the good things in the age in which we live. And then we can also figure out how do we not come under some of the assumptions or the things that are occurring in the church that are negative and hindering the things of God. So that's our task. And I think if I had to say, one of the primary purposes of this podcast is, can we bring awareness of the time in which we're living? Can we understand what drives us? But I'm not going to claim to know how to do that. So how do you balance? Like, I don't want to go back to some collectivist mindset where there's no individual responsibility, where I don't actually care about my own walk with God, where I don't have any knowledge of my spiritual gifts, where I entrust my religious faith to a priest. Like, I have no desire to do that. I think that was negative. I don't want to go back to even some of the Protestant things where, of course, there was wonderful stuff that happened, but I know enough of the theology of that time, enough of the practices of the church to say there's a lot of things that needed to change that weren't good. So I don't look at those times and say, oh, that was the best years. I instead say there's things that they did well that I honor, and then there's things they did that weren't good that we have changed. And a lot of the emphasis on expressive individualism, I think I could say, is really powerful because God cares about individuals, and Jesus leaves the 99 to pursue the one. The body of Christ is made up of parts, and each one of those parts has intrinsic value and worth. And that has been not emphasized at most of history of the church. And so there's something very wonderful about this age of authenticity and expressive individualism. Or even, you know, the reality that my Christian faith is not an issue of public performance in conforming to these cultural standards, but it's actually a deep heart for the Lord. And I have a genuine personal desire to love other people and participate in God's purposes. I view all of those as a wonderful thing and opportunity that we have living in the age we live in. At the same time, we also have to have our eyes open on the negative sides of that, of where our expressive individualism is hindering our growth in God. Mm-hmm. So it's not a simple black and white issue. Mm-hmm. It's going to take nuance and sifting through. And the reality is, none of us know the answer of how do we take some of the opportunity that's good from expressive individualism while weeding out what's negative, and how do we get to maybe a healthier way of expressing it in the church?
Yeah, and that goes back to being biblically formed, which has been another key theme in this podcast, that and this may be a good pivot to chapter 5, where he talks about, it's not a question of whether we inhabit the immanent frame, but how we inhabit the immanent frame, that we have been more formed by our culture than we are aware of, and we need to recognize that. And then how do we become faithful disciples of Jesus in that context? We need to grapple with that and become aware of those inputs that are forming us. But chapter 5 was a long chapter, and I know you have this note, but it stuck out to me, Drew, that Taylor almost takes a quasi-apologetic approach in chapter 5, but I appreciate his humility to say that he's not attempting to prove Christianity, the tenets or the propositions of Christianity. Rather, he's leveling the playing field and exposing some of the faulty logic of purely secularist thought, and at least elevating Christianity to a believable status when compared against the backdrop of this imminent frame, the secular world that we live in. But what was your take on chapter 5?
I love this quote from page 94 because I think it captures a lot of what he's trying to do throughout the book. He says this: "How you inhabit the immanent frame is less a fruit of deduction and more of a vibe. It's less of a reasoned position or articulated worldview and more of a Wittgensteinian picture that holds us captive precisely because it is not conscious." And I think that's a great way of saying what's going on here. So, you know, maybe the first part of that is more plain talk. You know, it's not logical proposition. It's a feeling. It's a vibe. The second, he's putting it in more, you know, referencing some philosophical thinkers and the way that he's describing it. But it's all kind of making that same point. So in other words, you can't escape the way that we live in the world. We view the world imminently. We don't think of the world as people did 1,000 years ago. And that's not going to change. It's not possible for that to change. It doesn't mean we have to accept the atheistic or a lot of the other things that obviously we strongly disagree with. But what it does mean is that we have a view of the world, and that's how we're going to inhabit it.
And for, just by way of disclaimer, we're talking about the Western world here. Drew, you've traveled all over the world.
Yes,
and,
of course.
You know, going to northern Uganda or central India, you're going to find people who still live in a very open-ended view of the world that has a deep appreciation for the transcendent as being part of everyday life.
Yeah, and if you're looking for like, what do I mean by when I say this, I'll give an example where a lot of earlier Greek philosophy, you know, would view certain objects as having a telos to them. So it's like fire, heat, or fire likes to rise because its goal is to go up, you know, as an example. We can't understand fire the same way. You know, we would instead talk about what happens in the chemical reactions and then why heat rises because of, I don't actually know the science of that one. I'm not even going to, I think I probably could figure it out.
Air density and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You get into all those kind of things. But that's, I can't not think of fire that way. I can't be like.
Straying outside of our lanes here.
Yeah, I can't be like fire is. It just has this like desire to go up.
Or
like,
lightning and thunder, right?
That
there's some tussle happening in the heavens. And but now, you know, we can look at that scientifically, that there's, again, you know, fill in the blank for the expansion of air from the lightning and the flow of electrons from one point to another causes the, you know, the sound effect of that we experience as thunder and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and maybe it's not fair to use scientific examples for this, but that's just one of so many things where I can't not think of the world through some of this. And so I want to put this disclaimer that I think God breaks into the world and reorders our understanding of the world. And I think that's so critical of us recognizing that God's acts of self-revelation are critical for us to break out of our preconceived unthoughts of the world. But at the same time, we do live in what he calls the immanent frame. Like we do live in a world where the world, at least our default position, is that it doesn't have as much mystery to it. And we're very much focused on the here and now and what humans do in the here and now. So even if a huge part of my life is thinking about eternity, thinking about the reality of a supernatural world, which I do, and by the grace of God, I want to do more, I still have this immanent understanding of the world that I'm not going to escape. And I'm not even going to necessarily say that's bad. It just is. Now, he helps break this down a little bit more. And I think this is, it's a little hard to track with. So if you're reading the book, I'm going to explain it. If you're not reading the book, hang with me for a second, but it might be a little harder to follow if you're not reading along. So what he does is he picture like a matrix, and on the horizontal axis, he has open and closed. And what he means by that is the world open to transcendence, meaning God active in the world, etc., or is the world closed? And that is the clockmaker universe, where everything can be explained by some type of natural law. Maybe you believe in a God who set it all in motion, but you don't believe that there is a God who is active, ordering.
Or who could be known.
Yeah, who can be known in any way, exactly. The other side is what he calls, so that the vertical axis is take and spin. And this one is a little harder to track with what he's trying to say. But what he is meaning here is, do you assume, so you take for granted that the picture is obvious and you can't even imagine otherwise. So this could be the, you know, picture the atheist who has no time for, you know, the stereotype of an atheistic scientist who has no time for anyone who would ever talk about anything supernatural that cannot be proven by science. It's just an assumption. Like, it's not even worth talking about. It's not even worth considering. The very thought of it is beneath me. Now, I'm taking a shot at an atheist. There's plenty of Christians who are the same way. You know, it's so obvious. I'm not even going to take the time to have dialogue with you because this is what it is. The other is more of a recognition of the limits of my understanding.
And that first would be a spin.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. I got it wrong. Yeah. The first would be spin. The second is take, where it's like, this is what I believe. But I'm also going to have the recognition that there are certain things I'm not going to be able to prove to you. And depending on the issue, an openness to dialogue. Now, where I might disagree with Taylor here is that I think it's right for us to stand on convictions. And I'll even take it further. Everyone stands on convictions. And I don't feel ashamed where I'm standing on a conviction, nor do I feel that I have to be able to meet somebody else's standard of proof to prove my conviction. I think what God has done in me, in our community, in history, is sufficient for me, and I can stand on that in a way where I'm very confident, and I don't feel like I owe it to somebody else that I then have to, you know, give them a math formula of why I do. So I don't view that as a negative thing. I view that as a positive thing. But I think, and I this is maybe my charitable reading of Taylor, is if I apply that to every area of life, that's where I'm arrogant. And so I, you know, even as I stand on certain things, and that's the realm of faith, there are other things where I'm going to approach it and say, you know what, I don't know. This is my conviction, and my convictions raise questions that I'm not going to be able to answer for everybody satisfactorily. And I'm just going to live with that tension.
You know, for the one or two of our listeners who might remember back to the first season, might be second season, we talked a little bit about Robert Keegan and Lisa Leahy's work out of Harvard on adult cognitive development. And they have a similar framework that was even more helpful than the idea of take and spin. And we talked about the socialized mind, which coheres externally, the self-authoring mind, which coheres internally. All my convictions are internal, and kind of that would be like a spin. It's closed to external dialogue. But the self-transforming mind, I do have an internal sense of coherence around my convictions, but it is open frame and open to being upgraded as I'm exposed to truth that more closely aligns with reality. And the goal is to work towards the self-transforming mind where myself coheres internally, yet I am open. This would be more of like a take, Charles Taylor's take, where I am open to dialogue. And if truth is truth, then I want to align with it and not get everyone else to align with my narrow understanding of truth.
Yeah, that's a great, yeah, you're probably right that work, I remember us reviewing it, I think it was one of our first episodes, and that's probably a more helpful way. I found Taylor is a little bit obtuse here. It's like you have to kind of read it a few times to try to catch what he's saying. What he does say, though, that I think is a great point is that whatever you choose is a leap of faith. So there is not a position out there that does not require a leap of faith. You have to start with some faith premise and assumption that orients everything else. So I have made the illogical choice to put my faith in only what can be proven by science. And so I think that's careful. This is my language. He doesn't say it quite like this. It's not logical. It's illogical. It's just faith. This is something that I've seen fruitful in the world, so I'm going to put my faith in it. That would be a closed frame, you know, or a closed view of transcendence. Like, I'm just not open to anything else because all I know I can trust is science. That requires no less faith than my choice to say I believe in a transcendent God who created the earth. Both of those are logical, and neither of those can be proven. Or maybe another way of saying I said illogical at the beginning. Illogical in the sense of neither of those can be proven through the standards that we would want to prove. So in that sense, they don't meet logical criteria that a lot of people want to put out. But they're both fair. It's fair to start there, but it's like we just have to be careful to say that is faith. That is not one mm-hmm. person gets the upper hand because they can somehow prove their faith assumptions.
Yeah, everyone has to start with unproven assumptions.
Exactly.
And build from there.
And he gets into hermeneutics then, page 96. The key idea here is those unproven assumptions are how we interpret the world. So hermeneutics is an interpretive grid. And what he says is we're not reasoning to belief.
Like from nowhere.
From nowhere, exactly. But we're reasoning from belief. So not reasoning to, the direction is not I am reasoning and I'm using my reason to land on faith. Instead, I have faith and then the faith becomes the foundation from which I reason and interpret the world. And that all, he has this idea of a closed world structure. Basically, we figured everything out. There's no outside interference. Everything is dictated by material cause and natural law. And Taylor calls this the illusion of rational obviousness of the closed perspective. And I love that, the illusion of rational obviousness. And what he's meaning by this is that this is a faith statement of how the world is that then creates an illusion that's obvious. It's almost like by me giving you the picture of the world and it so becomes embedded in you that it becomes obvious to you when in fact it was only a picture that I gave you. It's not something that any of us can actually prove, But it becomes so much a part of how you see the world that there's this illusion of obviousness to it that you can't even think otherwise. That then becomes your hermeneutic for everything else. So you just assume this is all there is, and so I can then interpret everything that happens based on my assumption. And in my mind, it's actually very peaceful because I don't have to think about anything else. It's just obvious.
And it might be worth noting again, what he makes a couple of comments, because for maybe some of us who hear that, we're like, well, then what is believable? You know, like, is my Christian faith? And so he steps in and he says, what I'm not trying to do is prove the Christian faith. What I'm trying to do is show that it is equally as plausible as some kind of imminent secular frame.
Yeah, and you said this, Mick, but I think that this is important at this point, is it's leveling the playing field. And so this is not an apologetic work in the sense that it's proving the Christian faith, but what it is doing is it is deprivileging the secular faith in the conversation. And that's why I made the comment last week. My faith is not in these things. My faith is in the God who has encountered me. And my faith is in the witness, the testimony of God's mm-hmm. work in the ages and in my own life and all this other stuff. But what this is doing is it's leveling the playing field to say that that foundation for my faith is equally as valid as somebody else's, you know, secular testimony. I don't have to be insecure when I'm arguing from the fact of what God has done in me as the foundation of my faith, because that's somehow less rational than somebody else who claims the foundation of science, which itself is not rational. So he's leveling the playing field, which then creates the space for us to not feel like we have to accommodate our testimony of what God's done in us to some type of neutral secular standard for it to become some type of reasonable belief system. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be very helpful. Now, he says, page 99, I just thought this was a good quote, but we've already hit it quite a bit, is that a lot of what's happening in secularism, and secularism too in particular, is it's unveiling reality by subtracting myth and enchantment. But he says, in fact, that's not the case. What's really happening is it's a construction, a social creation, an illusion that's being built for us to interpret how the world actually is. And mm-hmm. so I've made that point on every one of these episodes, but I just thought that was a nice a way of describing what he is saying here.
Right. And to that end, he talks about on the very next page that we are converting, and that's from the very first episode, you've used this language of when we talk about the secular belief system, the Christian belief system, Christians don't actually deconstruct their faith to this level playing ground. We're actually converting to another set of or another system of belief. He talks about this conversion to a new authority, not the assumption of intellectual independence. Just another way of saying we're not reasoning towards faith from that view from nowhere, but rather we're converting to a new set of assumptions that's based on some kind of authority.
Yeah, in this book, there's a quote on that page I want to read because I thought he wrote this like 13 years ago. You know, it's just so wild to see what's transpired. And actually, Taylor wrote it even further back. But Smith's comment is that anyone who wants to be, quote, with it, who wants to share her friend's humanist concerns about justice, is going to feel pressure to abandon faith and adopt a closed take. And so what he's describing is that is a conversion process. And if you analyze what he's saying, is there is a social desire to fit in with the elite discourse of society. There is an illusion, a take on the world, a social construction of how the world is. But the way that that's being felt on an individual level is that somebody wants to, you know, tackle this kind of humanist understanding of justice. That's actually what becomes the way that they're going to talk about what's going on there. And I'm like, that just described so many people the last 7 years. And he wrote this before, you know, the prominence of a lot of the deconstruction or ex-evangelical movement, but he called it. He called exactly what was going to happen. And I think we've seen this played out a million times over. And so what he's saying there, he's not saying that people don't have a legitimate concern for justice, but what he is saying is that their concern for justice is also tied into social mobility, tied into dominant discourse in society, and tied into a conversion into a different take on the world. It's not simply a concern for what's the way to be the most just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in that vein, he talks about cross pressure again, and that all of us inhabit this immanent frame, and we're not, most people aren't cross pressured between transcendence and immanence. Rather, we feel these cross pressures within immanence, and he highlights three of them: agency, ethics, and aesthetics. This is probably the closest he gets to apologetics, like true apologetics. But this idea that everybody has to wrestle with these phenomena, and I'll work at them in reverse. But aesthetics, this idea of beauty, value. I think the study is axiology. What do we do with that as immanent people who encounter these seemingly transcendent or these signposts that point at something outside of just a rational frame or ethics? And this would be mere Christianity, right? This is C.S. Lewis's whole argument based on the emergence of ethics that don't seem to rise naturally or rationally within a purely secularist or immanent frame. And then agency is, I mean, what you are is at the center of your PhD work, Drew, this idea of the agency of mankind. And how else would you say that from Smith's point of view?
Yeah, he's probably referring to it differently than what my focus is more on divine agency. But yeah, as I'm reading this, I think that ties probably to his take on expressive individualism. How much agency do I have in the world? How do I express it? I think a lot of our notion of justice comes from how we understand agency. Yeah, and I love cross pressure. You know, and I think what he's getting at here is these are areas where wherever I stand on them, there's somebody else out there that's breaking into my world with a different way of understanding it. So I don't get to quite feel settled in these different areas. And I want to build on what you just said, Mick, because he gets into a few things that I think are where his work gets a lot more street level, maybe, of what we experience. One, page 106, he's kind of talking about this idea of hermeneutic, of how we interpret the world. And he notes that we have moved from an awareness of sin to sickness. And I thought that was huge. Mm-hmm. We've moved from responsibility to victimhood and from moral to therapeutic. I was like, wow, you know, but you think about if I am an expressive individual, and if you can kind of take the story, if there is no major fabric that I'm a part of, if there is no right order that I'm responsible to, if all I'm responsible to is myself, then whatever's wrong is not a transgression on my part, but maybe as a sickness, and that could be in my body or somewhere else. Likewise, I'm not responsible to something beyond myself. I'm a victim of mm-hmm. something that's been imposed upon me. And it's not an issue of moral adherence, but it's an issue of therapy, of healing, of getting me back to a healthy place so that I can express myself.
Yeah, the locus of evil is external and exactly. not internal. That's Carl Truman, back to his analysis or his contrast of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's confessions and Augustine's confessions, where Augustine located his sin, his theft of the pears, in his mm-hmm. internally in his own sin, propensity to sin, whereas Rousseau located the evil of his own theft of fruit in poverty, injustice, all of these externals, and he was a victim of these external pressures. Again, probably truth to both, but the starting point for Augustine was sin located in the individual human.
Yeah, and Taylor balances this. He says the therapeutic revolution has brought a number of insights and approaches. So I'm not claiming, and Taylor's not claiming that our understanding of therapy, of the reality of mental illness, for an example, I think that's incredibly important. And I have nothing but honor for those who work in those fields, or the importance of whether it's talk therapy or medication or whatever needs to happen. So I think that's a very positive thing. And the awareness of that in our society is a positive thing. But what Taylor says, it's when it becomes a total metaphysic that it starts generating perverse results. So it's one thing to say that part of my humanity is mental illness, just like there's illness in my body. That shouldn't be a place of shame, but that should be a place of compassion and treatment and care. And I would fully agree with that. It's one thing to say that. It's another thing to say that that's all of my humanity. That there is no moral responsibility, there is no reality of sin or demonic influence or other things, that as a Christian, the fact of our mental makeup or even our family of origin and the things that might affect us That is important as a contributing part of who we are, but it's not the only part. Even if I could heal all of it, there would still be sin. Even if I do have a right, healthy way of understanding how I express myself in the world, I also have a responsibility for moral conformity to standards that are bigger than myself. Mm-hmm. So it's not that these things are universally negative. They just can't be total. And what he's saying is we're in a culture where they're becoming increasingly total, and that's where the problem is. So let's wrap with a few other thoughts here that I just thought were important. You know, all of this leads to an anthropological turn in which the only thing that God cares about is our flourishing. So this is page 115. Sacrifice becomes untenable, even unthinkable. And you see this, he even charts this like rejection even of certain atonement theories. Like we've so lost the idea of sacrifice because this world is all there is. What matters is human flourishing in this world, my ability to express myself as an individual in this world. Sacrifice does not fit within that story. The whole point of an imminent take is that there is no world beyond this world. We've so rejected dualism that we don't actually think about eternity. We don't actually think about a spiritual reality. And I think this is I think he's highlighting a really glaring danger for us as Christians, that there is benefit to our anthropological focus at one level because we do notice individuals and the unique beauty and value of those individuals. He offers a critique. I think Taylor takes it a little too far, and I think Smith offers a similar critique. But what Taylor says is he's saying there's a really healthy part for us as Christians of recognizing our embodiment as people, recognizing that there is a value in human flourishing, recognizing there's parts of our humanity that we need to be careful about, just assuming that they don't matter. So he's highlighting all of those different things, and that there is a very positive element of, I do believe that there is flourishing in this life based on the work of the Holy Spirit and based on our redemption in Christ. And so the anthropological turn has some good elements to it, but if taken too far, we lose sight of sacrifice. We lose sight of, and we start to reduce God in a way to becoming our butler, you know, who his job is to keep us happy and take care of our needs, rather than understanding God as our King. And this is what starts to happen to us. Any last thoughts, Mick?
Yeah, no, I appreciated Smith talks about Taylor's last chapter where he talks about these conversion stories and it lands it in a little bit more of a human frame, and all of us are navigating again from within this imminent frame. And I think all of this were all helpful reflections again from a spiritual formation standpoint. How do I, as a, you know, not to use generational language, but as a Zennial, a Gen X millennial who straddles some of the evolutions from these different ages, how do I follow Jesus faithfully in this context? How do I navigate these cross pressures? He talks about justice in some of these closing thoughts here. He talks about morality and how within the imminent frame, you can't make people moral. All you can do is specify rules. And I think a lot of our listeners have navigated over the past several years these social justice issues. And how do I faithfully follow Jesus and navigate the complex moral and justice-oriented society in which we live, and the failures of the church, and my participation as an expressive individualist in the church? And all of this has a very real bearing on how we understand ourselves as followers of Jesus, how we understand the church, how we understand our contribution to broader society. So some very helpful reflections. Again, if you haven't picked up the book, I'd recommend doing so.
Yeah, and he ends on a few things that I just think, you know, when you start to look at this story, you can actually make some predictions. What I found really powerful of reading this, I've read Taylor, but I hadn't read this, and I read Taylor before 2020 and a lot of change in our society. It's interesting to take his story, to take his predictions, and then now 13 years later to see how did he do. And I found his story becomes more plausible when his predictions came true, you know, is the way I read it. What Taylor says is that secularization that blames a religious past is going to become less plausible over time. And we mentioned that last week, but I think that is a prediction that we can make, is that increasingly there's going to be despair in secularism because they don't get to scapegoat the church anymore. Secularism is going to start having to stand on its own two feet. I'm in a lot of places that are very secular. You know, we spent the 5 months in San Francisco. I travel quite a bit. And what I find in those places is they're so removed now from Christianity that they don't have the benefit anymore of just blaming Christianity. And so there's actually a lot of spiritual hunger for people that are there. They might have some general political judgment about Christians, but they really have no idea. There's tremendous hunger for them. And a lot of that is because the field that they inhabit, they recognize that the secularism that they've been sold is not very good. And so they're looking for alternatives, and they're going to look everywhere. They're going to look in all kinds of places. And so I think that's where our own witness becomes so critical. But it is going to lead, I think, to increasing despair as people are forced to grapple with secularism is not doing what it is going to claim to do. And I think we can already see that if we have eyes for it. Now, living in a place like Waco, there's enough church and Christian influence that a secular person here can get away with just blaming Christians still. But that's not going to be the trend for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Smith had this footnote. It was footnote 10 in his conclusion, where he predicted the ex-evangelical movement, and this was prior to any of the crisis. I think the thing I saw here was trend versus trigger. So a trend is the long-range movement of people. A trigger is an event that happens. What we tend to do is focus on the trigger. So we can focus on whether it is COVID, Trump being elected, and Christian intertwined with politics, some of the various scandals in the church. And all those are really important things. So I'm not minimizing the importance of those. But what they did is they served as a trigger for what was already a trend. And so the danger is if we think we can fix the trigger, which we need to, all those things require attention. But if we think that we can fix the trigger and we're going to somehow solve, the problem of people turning away from the church, we've misunderstood mm-hmm. the problem. The real problem is that there's a massive societal trend that's decades, if not centuries, in the making. And yes, there are triggers, there are failures of the church, there are thorny problems that need solutions. All that's legit, all that's real, but there's also a lot of trends. He also predicted the neoliturgical kind of refocus that a lot of people are going through. I think that's his own journey, that's Smith's own journey. But I think what's going on there is people want to be anchored somewhere, and I think even though that's not my part in the body of Christ. I think that the point that he's making that I think is good for us is how do we make sure we're anchored in a story bigger than ourselves? Because I think that's desperately needed in a secular world. So with that, we'll conclude our book review of James K. Smith, who's reviewing Charles Taylor. We hope it's fruitful for you guys. I would highly encourage you, even if you're listening to this much later, pick up the book. I think you'll find it really interesting, and hopefully our thoughts help you to make sense of it more.
It's great. Thanks as always for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on Ideology.